I'm Bert Cohen, and it's time for The Bert Cohen Show. And the dream is about freedom and creativity, being free to do what you want and to make noise, to express yourself. It's about art and politics. Well, that's what today's show is about anyway. It often does intersect, and sometimes it's fun, sometimes it can be a little bit messy. It depends on your point of view, of course. Well, there's a new opening, a new discussion happening out in Los Angeles about the intersection of art and politics, and specifically what happened with regard to those topics in the 1960s, in the late 60s. And I have a feeling it's going to be a fun discussion today. Our guest on the Bert Cohen Show is Michael Dooley. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Hi.
Michael Dooley is the creative director of Michael Dooley Design in Pasadena, California, and teaches design history at Art Center College of Design, UCLA Extension, and Loyola Marymount University. He's also a print contributing editor and writes on art and design for a variety of publications. He's been involved in the arts for quite some time. His political involvement began in the mid-60s when he was a student at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. Well, again, thanks for being with us. What is the intent, the focus of this this show and discussion?
There's a six-month festival that has been going on. It started back in October, and it's wrapping up right now. It's a festival that really was talking about, has been talking about the idea that there was a lot going on in the early part of the century, and particularly in the 1960s, about in terms of art movements, about what was usually considered the what's usually considered the hub of activity was back in New York with the pop art movement, and yet there was a lot of activity out here. And the actual event that's being sponsored by the Getty basically involves 60, 70 different art institutions around, and they're all brought under the heading of Pacific Standard Time. Basically, Pacific Standard Time is saying that, you know, although you had, you know, movements like abstract expressionism and pop art going on in New York, there was also quite a bit of activity that was also noteworthy. And part of it has to do with politics. The actual span of time is from the 1940s through the 1970s. So it includes pop art, but it also gets into various other movements, including punk, and several of these shows have a political component. And so I've been doing a series about that for Imprint, which is Print Magazine's online edition, and I've got a weekly column that I do there for Print Magazine. And so that's it in general. That's the big overview. It's like Los Angeles, the art scene in the 1960s and into the 70s, which includes punk.
Well, certainly that's a fun period. And when one says the 60s, it's not like it started January 1st, 1960 and ended January 1st, 1970. You know, it's... like everything else, you know, it depends on your perspective. Certainly the early part of the 60s was very different from the later part of the 60s. In 1963, for example, Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, which drew attention to the state of American womanhood being really stifled. And that was an expression through writing. Roy Lichtenstein, I saw this painting just recently, painted this drowning girl painting, who is sort of comic book style. And in the painting, she was engulfed by waves, and she's crying and says, "Oh, she'd rather drown than call Brad for help." And, you know, there's mixing of political statements as well as artistic statements. Andy Warhol got his start back then. And obviously the big name in pop art, there was a lot of other art going on. James Rosenquist, as you've written about, was working on F-111, his big anti-war statement in 1965, when the subject of Vietnam was coming into public focus and more public consciousness. So arts were focused a lot on social concerns and changes on the horizon. I wonder about, you know, there's been a lot of discussion within philosophical circles, I suppose, about art and politics. Is, from your experience, Michael, should art be just art and just its own thing as it is, or can it be stating a political statement as well? Or does mixing the politics in kind of water down the art as a thing in itself? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think politics can and does invigorate fine art. And, you know, you can look at, in terms of the 20th century, one of the most obvious manifestations of that was Picasso's Guernica.
Yes,
you know, his reaction to the Spanish Civil War. But what you were talking about with regard to Lichtenstein and Warhol, they were artists, pop artists, who and Rosenquist certainly, who were getting involved in the political scene in the 1960s in a more subtle and oblique ways in the whole idea of, say, with Andy Warhol in his heyday, in the days that he was really producing work that he's known for and justifiably earned a place in the history books, was he was doing silkscreens like Race Riot and mm-hmm. which is actually about Bull Connor and you know, sticking his dogs on civil rights workers. And he had another silkscreen called The Electric Chair. And mm-hmm. You know, although it you know, it wasn't as overt as, say, Picasso and some of the works that he did, the content was still there. And and even more indirectly, you mentioned Roy Lichtenstein. I mean, Rosenquist's F-111 was this monumental painting that was really pretty blatantly anti-war, and this was in 1965, before the anti-war movement really heated up in a big way. But yeah, you take a look at Drowning Girl and some of Lichtenstein's other appropriations of comic book panels, mm-hmm. and at the time, it may have seemed even you know, relatively benign. There were a lot of people who were saying, "Well, you know, this person is just you know, taking comics and blowing them up, and that's all there is." But you know, right. that was particular type of comics that he was choosing, and the particular panels that really made him significant in a way that he was plugged into the zeitgeist and kind of expressing attitudes politically and socially before they really manifested themselves in an obvious way. So you have Lichtenstein doing. Basically, when he was doing his comics series, he was taking from two particular type of comics. One of them was the war books, where he would be showing these glorified early 1960s comic book stories about you know, the excitement and the the thrill and the bravado of fighting war with airplanes and on and ground combat. And this was really before Vietnam was really on people's radar the way they were, thanks to the protests. And as in terms of the one you mentioned, the Drowning Girl picture, that was part of his series on romance comics. And basically, he would very astutely zoom in on and choose particular comics panels that that were really expressive and anticipatory of, like you say, Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem also as well. We're just starting to write about the situations that women had been going through, enduring during the 1950s. And, you know, there was a, the times they were a-changing, and sure enough, his paintings became not less but more relevant as time went on, and and you had the feminist movement, and you had you know, women interested in liberation, and he was painting these scenes in a way that that really, whether deliberately or not, expressed you know, a certain oppression of women and the dependency of the patriarchy. So it's really interesting to go back and look at that.
Yeah, and really
at those sort of paintings
definitely stirred things up. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Michael Dooley about art and politics in general, and the late '60s. And I don't remember which politician, perhaps you do, who said, oh, he didn't mind the editorials, but it's those cartoons that concern him, because people get it. People, the artists, they're not born in a vacuum. The art doesn't come from nothing. We live, work, and create in a context. And as you were saying, the Lichtenstein and so many of the artists, pop artists and others of the late '60s. We're looking at the context perhaps before a lot of other people in the more traditional political way did, but that art itself can certainly make a huge, huge difference and be exceedingly powerful in politics. Now, certainly the right, the farthest right, the fascists, have always understood the power of art. You had, you know, on the furthest right you can get, the Nazis, who wanted very much to control art. They'd abscond with art that they liked, which exemplified what they thought was the best of German, you know, Teutonic spirit. And there was a degenerate art, which they would destroy. And they knew the power of art. And I guess that's one of the things that we're talking about here. And, you know, the period of the late '60s certainly doesn't start in 1960 and in 1970, and it has its predecessor in the 1930s. You mentioned Picasso's painting Guernica, which is about the it expresses the feeling, the horror of this little Basque village being bombed by the Nazis, and with the aid of the Franco fascist government. It was part of the social realism school of the 1930s. And certainly it does seem that part of the goal of the social realist artist was to increase political awareness. And I wonder when that kind of, you know, a more direct trying to stir up political awareness, I suppose it just sort of organically happened. It wasn't any particular time, but did it? Some of this probably started actually in the 1950s with the influence of the wonderful, amazingly powerful Mad magazine. You wrote a piece about Wally Wood, one of the artists for the early Mad magazines, back when they were more comic books. Of course, the authority figures dreaded the sight of that magazine. What is the artistic and cultural and even perhaps political significance of Wally Wood? Now, if anybody's ever seen, you know, historic Mad magazines, you've seen his drawings and his art. What about Wally Wood?
Oh, okay. You covered a lot of ground there. Just to go back real quickly to one of the first things you mentioned was the person you were thinking of was Boss Tweed.
Yes,
William Tweed, who basically in New York ran the Tammany Hall ring, and we're talking about times around the American Civil War, 1860s, and there was a man, the father of the American political cartoon, Thomas Nast.
Right.
Was drawing these pictures against the corruption that was the Tweed ring. And, Boss Tweed's reaction was, it's like he said, perhaps apocryphally, I don't care what the newspapers write about me. My constituents can't read.
It's those damn pictures.
Talking about the people who voted for him and kept him in office. But, you know, stop those damn pictures, and that was really, that was a matter of the politics of the left. In that case, back in those days, it was the Republican Party,
right.
And Thomas Nast writing for Harper's Weekly, illustrating for Harper's Weekly, that was just viciously attacking him and doing a hell of a job with it. And
just shows the power.
Pardon me?
It shows the power of the art.
Yeah, and we'll get back to Wally Wood in a
sure, second, sure.
But it's interesting how things have changed. I mean, certainly the editorial cartoons still can stir up trouble when you think of the Danish newspaper that hired those people to do their caricatures of Mohammed, and but you know, things are still, they're taking a different sort of form, and now you have shows like the Daily Show that are doing their own editorial cartoon thing in broadcast television form, where they're basically showing clips of these people, what they're saying, and juxtaposing them with the realities, and so that's in a way, the editorial cartoon is alive and well with Jon Stewart.
And that's his creativity.
Wally Wood was someone who is recently starting to have a revival, in the sense that there are books that are coming out, monographs on Wood, and the work, the milieu that he was doing back in the mid 1950s, back when Mad magazine was just a comic book, and he was the work I think you're talking about was the work that was written by a guy, the editor at Mad at the time, Harvey Kurtzman, who was working for EC Comics, and he was actually in the early 1950s, and this is the time of the Korean War. He was putting out stories. He had he was editing comic books called Frontline Combat and Two Fisted Tales that were not only historically amazing, they were also amazing in their perspective of war, viewing war on a human scale and making it not that glamorous. You know, I talked about, by the early 1960s, the typical war comic was glorifying war.
Oh, yes.
But Kurtzman was very astute and liberal politically, and so he would, show the human side of war and all its grittiness and with all its issues, and he was also a social satirist, and he would use his staff, people like Wally Wood, Jack Davis, Will Elder was certainly one that that also satirized society. I mean, he would in those old Mad comic books, he would do a say a parody of the TV show called at the time was called What's My Line, and you know, long story short, he actually had Senator Joseph McCarthy that he was, and he was caricaturing and basically ridiculing them. And it was being done in a comic book format, so it was really subversive in a way that it was entertaining to kids, but it was also it was putting forth a message that could affect people like me when I was a kid. And right. And reading these things, they were kind of like, you know, tiny time capsules that you know, would later explode in the brain as you became more aware of the horrors that were McCarthyism and the rest of it. And so Wood and the rest of the EC gang were very adept at making these cartoons appealing to young people in their formative years. So it was very very subversive. Yes. In a very good way.
We are talking with Michael Dooley about art and politics and subversiveness. And, you know, certainly Adolf Hitler and his gang understood the power of art to be subversive. And certainly nowhere near that far right, but we still have a pretty far right wing these days taking over the Republican Party, which, as you mentioned, used to be the Liberal Party, actually. And they're not really into art. I'm sure they fear it as well. It's like you said, Mad Magazine, you know, coming into the house, the parents could probably cringe at the potential for subversion there. And just wondering about the right wing in American politics these days and any suggestions you've heard about their concern about art and its power to be subversive.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, certainly one good example that's coming up, if not fine art, then in the popular arts, is the situation with Sarah Palin, where it's you know, where it's now coming out that you know, exactly what an effect Tina Fey had, not only on Sarah's psyche, in the sense that you know, there was that recent
HBO
dramatization of Palin on TV, where she was just, you know, sitting and staring at Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live, watching herself be ridiculed. And then it's now also coming out that Tina Fey's caricature was something that actually did have an effect on the voting public. And so, you know, again, the caricature that television was is now doing is a you know, is a more recent manifestation that the caricatures, you know, the vicious caricatures that Thomas Nast drew of Boss Tweed were, you know, in their time, you know, Tweed was a you know, a vulture in a bag of money, and all sorts of other caricatures, and also, you know, the way Kurtzman Wood and the others were caricaturing the times in the 1950s. But you also mentioned the other thing that you mentioned regarding the political times in the 1930s. The idea that Hitler would put on shows. He had this one particular gallery show of degenerate art that was supposed to be, and in fact was, attacking Nazis before World War II, and it was put on. It was called the Degenerate Art Show, and it was put on in tandem with another show that was supposed to be one that was actually that socialist realism that glorified
the struggles of average,
you know, the
people.
Wonderful state of Nazism that was arising. But it was the Degenerate Art Show that was actually the one that got more attention, and there were, you know, there were people, there were, you know, expressionists and Dadaists that were doing work that was in fact subversive, and it was touching people in a nonverbal way, touching people in a way that was felt more viscerally, and thus had its own power. And Hitler did, it was very right to be worried about those sorts of attacks.
It was very popular. That was the most popular show, I understand, the degenerate art. Probably lines right around the block, I imagine.
Works by expressionists and Dadaists and the rest of it. And you take the work at that time. Certainly the great political caricaturist in Germany at the time, following in that Thomas Nast tradition, John Hartfield. He was basically appropriating images from the media. He would do these collages that took images that people were familiar with. They'd be photo montages, works that people in Germany could identify with, and he would use them in a he would use photography the way Thomas Nast used his illustrations to caricature, ridicule, and mock the rise of Hitler and his whole regime at the time, to the point where when things got so hot in Germany, Hartfield finally had to
split,
had to flee the country. But that kind of a predetermined situation.
Fascinating about being able to ridicule, mock, make fun of. It takes that bravery, that creativity, and that's what art is. I hadn't really considered, but I think your point about the late night shows that mock a lot of the power politics, that's art. That's their stage. I mean, what is art? It's working on various different mediums, being as creative and free as you can. And I think that's one of the things about art, is that it can be free enough to subvert. And, we talk about Mad Magazine. It was certainly very influential, certainly on my generation, the baby boomers, that it sort of legitimized and made us, I think, kind of accept the idea that you can make fun of power, you can make fun of pop culture, and get away with it, which being a serious politician might not kind of have that same freedom. And it's about your perspective on art. There's the impressionist, the expressionist, people who whatever they choose to focus on, and people can look at various different things outside or inside, and if somebody takes a photograph of it, that's creating an image. And that's, of course, what artists do, is take a look at something and sort of, it's not, somehow just transform it into something else. And one of the people of the late 60s who I did have on the show quite a while ago, who was very much influenced by Mad Magazine, I think he actually perhaps worked with Mad Magazine, Paul Krasner, eventually put out The Realist Magazine. And I loved The Realist Magazine tagline, "The truth is silly putty." That was beautiful. Silly putty was so popular at the time. I could pick it up and stick it down somewhere and just transform it. And of course, he was one of the founders of the Yippies, the Youth International Party. I wonder if you could, Michael, tell us a little bit about Paul Krasner as this kind of artist affecting art and politics, and just sort of mixing the two together to make real political change.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's a there's a direct link. There's a continuum between Mad Magazine, which, as I said, in the mid 1950s, it was in its comics form, and when it transformed into a magazine to bypass the repression that was going on there at the time, when comic books were seen as the corrupter of youth.
Yes.
Mad changed from being a comic book to a magazine, and Paul was writing for them there as well, and it was kind of a training ground for him in those early days of the magazine for what became The Realist, which started, I believe, in 1958. So not that long after he was writing for Mad. Yeah, it was The Realist was this satirical magazine. The original the original line that he used was free thought, criticism, and satire, and that's pretty much what it was. They had no sacred cows, and they were. It was also a nice transition for people who, say, you know, in their younger days, and I include myself among that group, who were weaned on the Mad comics and the whole EC line, that whole idea of being a kid in 1952 and discovering what's basically an anti-war comic in the work that Kurtzman was doing, and again the EC Mad and Panic was another one put out by Al Feldstein, also from EC. Just as the writing for Mad was a transition for Paul, reading Mad was a transition into The Realist when you basically had more an adult humor and satire going on, and The Realist was extremely groundbreaking at the time. In fact, Paul brings up the he's often quoted as saying when it's noted that People magazine called him the father of the underground press. He said, "I demanded a paternity test," but really, in the late 1950s, there was no alternative magazines that had the kind of punch that Malcolm Muggeridge's punch did over in England, and that was part of the impetus for Paul to another impetus for Paul to start up The Realist. So you had The Realist and The Village Voice, which is a local Greenwich Village publication that was actually an inspiration for not only the underground newspapers that followed, like the East Village Other and the Berkeley Barb and the LA Free Press, but it was also inspirational for the underground comic scene as well. There were quite a few people that Paul Krasner featured in his magazine that went on to become underground cartoonists, just as Harvey Kurtzman, a little bit more further along the line, when he had moved on from Mad to a magazine, he started Help. He started Help magazine, which was another more adult humor magazine, and that was one of the first places in which underground artists like Robert Crumb had a chance to experiment and to see their work in print. So, both Kurtzman and Krasner were very influential on underground comics.
Boy, I did not know that R. Crumb had been with Help magazine. Boy, you're bringing back some memories today. That's, it's fascinating how, underground comics at the time, the East Village Other, and so many of these things were derided. Parents, of course, didn't like it, which, of course, made it more attractive to us boomers. But now, Crumb, the monographs sell for many hundreds, sometimes probably thousands of dollars. And it's fascinating to me how, bringing in the sort of, not high art, not fine art, but the art of the streets, if you will, that, you know, sometimes kids could see art as, oh, that boring stuff coming down from the authorities. But this is different. I mean, it could be graffiti, for that matter, which, I mean, what's his name there? Hansen, I think it is, Dwayne Hansen. I think that's the artist. Maybe I have the name wrong. But there's a lot of artists who started out as graffiti artists who, you know, came up from the streets and have that sense of subversion. And the popularity of the underground comics is something that's, you know, really helped define our generation, really. And I can see the straight line between Mad Magazine and Help and even Monocle Magazine, which I think had something to do with Paul Krasner, although I'm not sure. But just that satire, the making fun of, being able to stand in a place and say what you want and make your expression without fear. Only artists seem to have that, and that certainly says a lot about politics in this country and the creativity and freedom, which is what America's supposed to be about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Monocle you mentioned, that was a magazine that was edited by Victor Novosky, who
of The Nation.
The editor of The Nation, right. And yeah, the connection was there were basically the people at the time, and now we're talking, say, early 1960s.
Yes.
They were using the same writers. Marvin Kittman was appearing both in the Realist and Monocle, and Monocle was the magazine in which Marvin Kittman launched his election campaign. He was actually ran for president on the as a Lincoln Republican, talking about the good old days when Republicans were on the side of sanity, and so you know that was Monocle was part of that whole subversive milieu that was blossoming around the early and mid 1960s.
And we talked a bit about Paul Krasner and, you know, how he moved from, you know, going from Mad Magazine to The Realist to starting the Yippies, the Youth International Party. Now, the political context of the time was, you know, the anti-war movement was really getting going. There had been the whole civil rights struggle where there was, you know, it got kind of ugly sometimes and it took a lot of bravery. And then there was the channel of the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. But they were kind of boring. They were strictly politics. There wasn't any sense of humor. And people like Paul Krasner and Abbie Hoffman and others created Yippies to incorporate some of this satire, poking fun of. You mentioned about sacred cows earlier, and that reminded me about one of my many favorite lines of Abbie Hoffman. He said, "Sacred cows make the best hamburger."
Right, yeah, I remember that.
So what about that connection between the satire of the comics, Mad Magazine and others, and this political thing like the Yippies, which of course nominated a pig for president in 1968 using images to tell their story with no money at all?
Yeah, I think that's all part of that you know, that idea that you know, revolution you know, should be fun.
Right.
You know, it should be you know, the idea of you know, having a party in both senses of the term.
Mm-hmm.
The one that would and in the case of the Yippies, one that would run Pegasus, the pig, for president in 1968. And I know it was around the mid 1960s that I first came to know Paul, and you know, so we were he was teaching a class at the Free University of New York, which was basically, it was a Marxist school. It was actually just a little school that was over a delicatessen on 14th Street.
How convenient.
And they asked him to do a session on the media, and he was saying, okay, as long as I can make fun of you guys, because, Paul was very independent in that sense. He actually started an organization called the United Non-Joiners, and so they said, sure, you can make fun of him. So he would bring people, guest speakers, to these sessions. People like Abby and Jerry Rubin and
Stu Albert,
Emmett Grogan of the Diggers. I know Michael O'Donohue one time was a guest. This was back before his Saturday Night Live days. This was back when he was still writing a comic strip for Evergreen Review, Evergreen Magazine, illustrated by Frank Springer, called Phoebe Zeitgeist. And so he'd really bring in these people who were working on not only being in tune with the zeitgeist, but changing it, and that was part of it. It was like that whole sense of humor, that whole business that revolution shouldn't be taken so seriously. It should be fun. In fact, one of Abby Hoffman's books was called Revolution for the Hell of It. And that was a place that Free University space was where the so-called conspiracy to invade the Democratic convention in Chicago in 1968, where all that was happening. I sat in on some of those meetings, and certainly Abby was, a lot less serious and more fun than Jerry Rubin.
Oh,
so
yeah.
he was definitely the one that I think attracted the more attention, in the sense that he would appeal to people on a more visceral way, and that's really a better way to reach the hearts and minds of people than a whole lot of boring dogma and speeches and the rest of it, because you're really you're engaging their spirit as well as their intellect. So definitely humor is subversive, and you were talking about the right wing, knowing the power of the media. I think I don't think that the right wing has ever done quite as well at humor as the left has, and so that's certainly to the credit of people like Paul. I mean, the Realist was really pivotal in its time, and it really helped define and form the 1960s. As we know it, like you say, the 1960s is not so much a decade as a state of mind.
Right. It's a spirit. Like when Judge Julius Hoffman asked Abby Hoffman, no relation, where he lived. He said he was here. He's in America, and his full time, he's an activist. And it was incorporating art into politics. Very, very powerful stuff. And one of the, expressions of art, of course, is music. And in the 1950s, there was something called rock and roll being born. And part of the threat there to the power structure was that there were Black people involved. This was integrated. It wasn't top down. The rock culture was having white kids dance with Black kids. Ooh, that was scary stuff, very dangerous stuff. And then you go on into the later 60s, when rock is still where people are. It's where us baby boomers were. Abby tried to connect that, and to connect rock and make it fun, and certainly incorporate what the earliest yippie, I suppose, Emma Goldman, said, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. You got to have fun to incorporate that, and to try to make that movement And nowadays, you have a lot of, you know, younger people who are watching The Daily Show, and it's fun. It's got to be fun. And, you know, the power of mixing, you know, black culture, which was, you know, officially to be kept down, that was some real powerful stuff. And I don't know if that could have been done any other way except through music, through rock and roll. And it's still quite powerful if people use it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that whole idea of, you know, if people caricature the 1950s as an era of Eisenhower
conformity,
oppression, and conformity, and the rest of it, they're really ignoring. I mean, not only the beats, you know, like you know, Ferlinghetti and the all that action at City Lights in San Francisco, but they're also ignoring the pop culture aspect of it. And yeah, you're absolutely right. The you know, the fact that not only was Elvis, he was bringing together in his music, in his groundbreaking music in 1954, 5, 6, you know, he was bringing in the rockabilly aspect, but he was also, you know, bringing in the R&B sound as well. He was, you know, it was his blend of rhythm and blues and country and western was really you know, groundbreaking in a way that you know, only in retrospect are we able to realize and appreciate. And yeah, people on the radio, DJs were breaking rock and roll records, and in the sense that they were the establishment, they had a right to be afraid of you know, you had you know, people like Chuck Berry, who was also working, you know, a black performer working in the kind of rockabilly tradition, and Little Richard, who was you know, very unapologetically flamboyant in his act. And yeah, like you say, it was something that was, you know, it was you know, I give it a 10 because you can dance to it, as
exactly.
to say on Dick Clark's American Bandstand. And yeah, and the fact that you know, that suddenly blacks were being able to be seen not only as performers, but, you know, integrated on the dance floor, was just absurd. When you think, you know, back in the, you know, the 20s and 30s, there were movies that that were actually being censored down south when you had swing music going on, and it was black people basically doing these exuberant swing dances with you know, these wild aerials and the rest of it, and back then those sections of movies had to be clipped out. And this is the 1930s, not that far, because, you know, they didn't want to show black people having fun. And then suddenly the, you know, the 1950s, all that changed. You know, teenagers themselves became you know, a powerful entity in the way that they never had before. And so it all just gelled at a very very exciting time. Anyone who thinks that the 50s was nothing but a downer really needs to sit down to some of those great old rock and roll oldies that Alan Freed was playing on the radio.
And it was great fun. It was great fun. And one of the, you know, you talk about the breaking the rock records, all the concern about integration with rock music. That, to me, was the beginning, the very first ignition of the culture war. And I got to tell you, sitting here in 2012, it seems to me that the liberals, the progressives, the left, whatever, we won the culture war. The, you know, Pat Buchanan talked about it in his famous 1992 speech at the Republican Convention for the soul of America. I wonder about connecting that culture, which, you know, has so been clearly victorious in terms of, you know, fighting against racism, women having equality, you know, anti-imperialism, anti-militarist. We've kind of won, really. But how, I wonder what, Michael, you see in terms of art mixing with politics, making it happen. I mean, I can see various different ways of just people appreciating art. There's street art right now. You know, there was a battle here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where the show originates, over street art. People had painted on buildings, and some people got all upset about that. But I wonder about the intersection, again, which is kind of where we started, of culture and politics, art and politics. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely made its way into the streets, that and the 1960s is really a touchstone for that. Recently, there was Shepard Fairey, the street artist, who excuse me, I wrote a feature on back in the early days of his career, with the back when he was doing his Andre the Giant Obey stickers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's obviously come along a long way, and with his Obama campaign, and he was speaking recently at one of the classes I teach. We've kept in touch all this time, and he talks about how his part of his roots, part of his inspiration, have to do with, just to bring it back to high art again, Andy Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
The way that Andy Warhol recycled cultural icons was part of what he was doing. You have people like Shepard Fairey, and before him, Robbie Canal, who's also a local here in L.A., and other people like Barbara Kruger, who started out doing street art, for feminist causes, and so there's all these wonderful things that were happening. Basically, starting with Robbie taking to the streets with his Ronald Reagan anti-Reagan Iran-Contra business, and being carried through Shepard, and even up to Banksy. In a way, Banksy is part of the tradition, the trajectory that you can say pinpoint having started back in the days of the Dada movement, and continuing on through the situationists of the 1960s, that idea of turning the culture against itself, and so there are all these all these barriers are blurring now. The whole high art, popular art divides are joyfully getting all mixed up and creating something new, and part of that through line is humor. The Dadaists had a really nasty sense of humor, and this is back in the early teens.
Right.
And their spirit certainly lived on with Abby Hoffman.
Yes.
and Paul Krasner and the Yippies. That whole Yippie spirit that he was, in the 1960s, he was throwing, dollar bills onto the floors of the New York Stock Exchange during trade time, and that's how many, a half a century before Occupy Wall Street.
I know.
He was there doing it.
Well, it's like it's performance art, really, and art can be,
know,
incorporating it into your life. You mentioned joy and festivity and bringing a sense of aesthetics into one's everyday life. And I think that's a lot of what the Yippies were about. And certainly it does seem to have some roots with regard to Andy Warhol, just taking what could be more common than a box of Brillo or a can of Campbell's soup and just transforming the streets into theater. It's just wonderful, and I think it's tremendously powerful in terms of politics. Do you see young artists doing that now? I don't know that much about what's going on in terms of art, but I'm suspecting it's still using that kind of festivity and joy.
Oh, yeah. Well, Banksy, the street artist in England is doing is certainly part of that. And yeah, to mention, well, with regard to Warhol and the Campbell soup cans, you know, that was part of that that whole you know, discussion, the divide between what we used to consider high art by, you know, the subversive idea of actually painting a you know, basically a proletarian blue collar working class product and putting it in the museum is all part of that. And yeah, the you know, the performance art, you know, back in the 1950s and 60s, they would call it happenings, but it was the same thing. It was the same thing as that, you know, Hugo Ball and the Dadaists started doing back in 1912 in Zurich when they got up on stage at the Cabaret Voltaire, and they were, you know, they were you know, creating nonsense. They were really anti-culture. They were doing, you know, they preceded the culture jammers, you know, the sort of thing that Adbusters magazine was was doing. All this, you know, all this great culture changing, you know, and you have to really, you know, you could throw in the punk movement as well. Certainly, you know, Jamie Reed was part of that whole situationist aesthetic in terms of his graphics for the Sex Pistols, and you know, even what Malcolm McLaren was doing in creating the Sex Pistols in the first place, that whole do-it-yourself aesthetic that was really, you know, so liberating to people. It's
liberating. That's a key word here. Liberating.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if people are interested in following more of your writing, and it's some fascinating writing, I guess they can just Google Michael Dooley, or is there some other specific?
And print magazine, I guess. Well, or actually, they could go to I write a weekly column for print magazine's online edition, and that's imprint.printmag.com.
All right.
Excuse me, .com. imprint.printmag.com. And that's the homepage. And my name's here. You can click on that. And I write about comics, high art, low art, graphic design, design culture. It's all there. And a lot of it definitely has a political edge.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Michael Dooley. We're going to close out with a song about Andy Warhol from Lou Reed and John Cale. Thank you so much.
You've got the money, I've got the time. You want your freedom, make your freedom mine. 'Cause I've got the style it takes. Money is all that it takes. You've got connections and I've got the art. You like attention and I like your looks. And I have the style it takes. And you know the people it takes. Why don't you sit right over there? We'll do a movie portrait. I'll turn the camera on, and I won't even be there. A portrait that moves. You look great, I think. I'll put the Empire State Building on your wall for 24 hours glowing on your wall. Watch the sun rise above it in your room. Wallpaper art. Great view. I've got a Brillo box, but I say it's art. It's the same one you can buy at any supermarket. 'Cause I've got the style it takes. And you've got the people it takes. This is a rock group called the Velvet Underground. I show movies on them, do you like the sound? 'Cause they have a style that grates. And I have art to make. Let's do a movie here next week. We don't have sound, but you're so great, you don't have to speak. You've got the style it takes,
kiss.
You've got the style it takes,
eat.
You've got the style it takes,
couch.
You've got the style it takes.